So this morning today we have mostly a gadita. Yeah. Truth is, when it comes to gadita, it's always a little bit iffy on my part. But sometimes you need more preparation for a gadita than for halacha. And given my crazy Tuesday schedule, anyway. So we're on Daf Chaf Dalet Amud Aleph. Let's just see where we're up to. We have a sugya called Migu, but again, as I mentioned yesterday, we should not confuse Migu in our sugya here on Daf Chaf Dalet with classic Migu in all of the Bavas, where a person puts forth one claim, and if he was lying, he could have put forth a better claim. So if you take a look at the last few words on Chav Gimel Amid Beis, Ki Asa Ravin Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Ravin comes from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel with a different transmission of Rabbi Yochanan. Again, an attempt to interpret Rabbi Meir. We're always stuck with Rabbi Meir. How could Rabbi Meir say that the Baal Din himself? I'll clean this all up later because I need a certain.
Okay, are these yours?
Oh yeah, these are mine. Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
So that how could Rabbi Meir possibly say that the Baal Din himself, the we called it the defendant, right, Shimon, who's now being sued for a large sum of money, that he could disqualify the witnesses of Reuven, the Toveah, the plaintiff? How is that possible? He's a Nogeh B'Eidus. So now we have a slightly different transmission of what Rabbi Yochanan said to interpret Rabbi Meir. And this introduces the sugya of Migu. So we start with the last word on Chav Gimel Amud Beis, and then we go on to Chav Dalet Amud Aleph. Resha b'edim psulim v'dayanim ksherim. In the case where Bezdin does their research, and they find out that the claim of Shimon, of the Baal Din, of the Nitba, that the Edom were actually disqualified, turns out to be a very true claim, that we can bear it out with the facts. We do the research, the evidence comes into Beis Din, and indeed the claim of the Nitba, of Shimon, that these Edom of Reuven were psulim, turns out to be a true claim. You know, let's say we find the Edom Zomimim, whatever evidence we need, or we can establish that they're related in some way. Now, the Baal Din wants to say that not only were the Edom psulim, but even the Dayanim were psulim. And Rabbi Meir's logic is that Migu de Pasli Edom, Pasli Nami Dayanim, that to the same extent that we see that the truth is the truth of the statement of the Nitba was borne out, and his claim that the Edom were psulim was substantiated, then we should also believe his claim that the Dayanim were psulim. So I saw here in a note in the name of the Yad Ramah, which is the super commentary in the Rishonim on Sanhedrin, he says that the logic of Rabbi Meir is that if Reuven brings two witnesses and they turn out to be psulim, and we're not going to rely totally on the claim of the nidon, of the nitba, but rather we did, shall we say, independent research and investigation, and the truth of his claim, of Shimon's claim, is borne out, then we begin to suspect Reuven that he is setting up this whole din in order to win money that's not justifiably his. So what does he do? He brings in two Edim that are psulim, and he appoints Dayanim who are psulim. If I understand the Yad Ramah correctly, then what we're talking about is what I call a reyusah. Are you familiar with the word reyusah? Reyusah means when a person who we would assume normally based on chazaka that he's a kosher, but we see that he's he's playing hanky panky over here. He's not doing everything the way he should be doing. Why did Reuven bring in Edim Psulim? Something here is not kosher. That's called a reyusah. So when you begin to think that something is not kosher, there's some sort of a stain on someone's taint on someone's reputation. So in the language of the Yad Ramah, he says, "Kasher nimtzu ha'edim psulim." When the edim turn out to be psulim, and now he says that the same Reuven, the Tovea who brought these edim psulim against Shimon, now brings so and so and wants to appoint him as the judge to adjudicate this case. You know what? Let's see if he could be mavarer, if he could clarify the status of this judge or these judges, that they're really kshirim. You know, he was not successful in clarifying the status of the edim. Let's begin to wonder as to the status of the dayanim. That's called, in the language of the Gemara, migu de pasli edim, pasli nami dayanim. So it doesn't mean that we're going to come to a definite conclusion that the dayanim are certainly psulim, but we begin to suspect that to the same extent that the edim were psulim, maybe, and that we were able to substantiate, to establish, maybe the dayanim were also psulim. Ubisefa, and the next case of the machlokas between Rab Meir and the Chacham recorded in the Mishnah is Dayanim Psulim V'Edim Ksherim. Once again, Reuven brings Dayanim and he brings Edim. And in this case, when the Nidon says, right, the Nidon meaning Shimon, right, he's the defendant, when he says to Reuven, "Your Edim Psulim and your Dayanim Psulim." And we checked out the Dayanim, and lo and behold, it turns out that the MS bears out what he says. The Dayanim were really psulim. They did not, either they were related to one of the Bali Dinim, or related to each other, or perhaps they weren't Bekiyim B'din, they didn't know the Halacha. So once we have already established that the Dayanim that Reuven brought for his case were psulim, migu de pasli Dayanim, pasli nami edim. We begin to wonder what is the status of these edim, and now we're going to have to adduce proof and evidence to establish the validity and the qualifications of these edim. And therefore, Rabbi is saying, until you do so, Mr. Reuven, Mr. Tovea, then we're not going to believe your edim either. Now, in both of these cases, the Chachamim reject Rabbi Meir, and they never accepted migu. Maskifle Rava asks the kash on Ravin's transmission of Rabbi Yochanan Bishleim. I understand migu de pasli edim, pasli nami dayanim. What we're saying is that if the Tovea, if Mr. Reuven, brought in edim psulim, so you know what? It's not geferlich. It's not so terrible or catastrophic if we question the status of his dayanim. Why? Because ika beidine achrina. We can always say to Reuven, look, your case is not lost. You're not, to use a Yiddish phrase, aftzalachas, you're not lost here, because ikah beidin achrina, take your case to a different bezdin, and maybe you'll be better off in a different bezdin, and there the judges will be on the up and up, and they'll be acceptable. So by questioning the status of the judges in this bezdin, we have not undermined the position of Reuven the Tovea, because he can always have recourse to go to a different bezdin. But Ella, Rava says, Rav Meir is really pushing it too far in the case of Migu de Pasli Dayanim Pasli Nami Edim, that if we can establish based on the claim of the of Shimon the defendant to Nitba that the Dayanim are questionable, now you're going to tell me that we're going to believe him to say that the Edim are not reliable, Va'edim Suleka, he's not going to have any recourse to take his case Reuven to another Bezdin and produce another pair of Edim. He only has one pair of Edim. So how could it be that Rabbi Meir is going to apply the Migu case from Dayanim to Edom? If you're going from Edom to Dayanim, as we say, it's Nishkeferlach, it's not so terrible, because even if we question the status of Dayanim, Ruvain, the Toveh, still has recourse to take his case to a different Bezdin, and there he'll be more successful with those Dayanim, and they'll be Ksherim. But in the case of the Migu, that Migu de Pasli Dayanim is Pasli Nami Edim, that because we found Shimon's claim to be true with regard to the Dayanim, and that's going to force Reuven to take his case to a different Bezdin, therefore we should believe Shimon to Pasli Edim, and now Reuven is in a situation where he has no other Edim. Certainly there's no basis to believe the claim of Shimon if we don't have any objective evidence, because Shimon himself is an Oger B'Edus. Of course he wants the apostle of these Edom. These Edom are coming to testify that he owes 1,000 dirham to Reuven. Lo tzricha, but rather, what's the case of our Mishnah? De'ika kat acheres. Now, Rabot, so we come full swing back to the discussion of Reuven, who has two different units or katim, kitos of Edom. He has one kat of two Edom, and he has another kat of two Edom. Now the Baldin, meaning Shimon, says about the first kat of Edom that they are psulim. So even if we accept the claim of Shimon, and again keep in mind, Rabbos, we said this a million times, that Shimon comes to Bezdin together with another person, so we have a kat of Edom that possibly's Edom, Reuven still has recourse to subpoena his second pair of Edom and win the case with the second pair of Edom. So Rabbi Meir is only going to believe the Nitba, meaning Shimon, to claim that Reuven's Edom are psulim only in a case where Reuven has another pair of Edom. So the Gemara says, what are you telling me? You're telling me that from Reuven we're going to derive the conclusion, right, that if there was only one pair of Edom, then Rabbi Meir would agree that the Nitba has no authority to disqualify that one single pair of Edom that Reuven has. Holeka karacheres, my hokinami de lo motzi posel. That if there was only one pair of Edom that was subpoenaed by Reuven the Tofea, then even Rabbi Meir would agree that the Nitba, Shimon, has no right to say, well, I know that these Edom are psulim, he certainly is an Oger, but the Rahainu Rav Dimi. Then what in effect, Reuven is adding nothing to Rav Dimi, because if you remember Rav Dimi, that we discussed at great length yesterday, his explanation of the Machlokas between Rav Meir and the Chachamim was in a case where the Reuven comes into Bezdin, and he bangs on the table, and he says, I have two pairs of Edom. And that's where Rav Meir says that when he brings his first pair of Edom, we believe the Nitba, that means Shimon, the defendant, to claim that these Edom, again he has another buddy to testify with him, are psulim, because Reuven the Tovah has another pair of Edom. So now what comes out is that Reuven is doing nothing other than repeat what we already know from Rav Dimi. So Gemara says, nein, it's not exactly the same. Ika beinayu, the difference between these two interpretations is migu. Demar sovar, according to this last transmission of Reuven, he's of the opinion that Amrinan migu, which means that through the migu, Rav Meir is of the opinion that we believe the nidon to apostle both the Edom and the Dayanim. Umar sov of Rav Dimi, that was the original formulation, that version, Rav Yochanan, lo amrinan migu, we're not going to say migu. And therefore, if we don't say migu, we cannot passel the Edom based on migu. So therefore, in the second presentation, and we're going to have to, I'm sorry, in Rav Dimi, that's the first interpretation, in the first presentation, we're going to have to interpret that there were two pairs of Edom. He brought one pair of Edom, and then he claims that he has in his back pocket a second pair of Edom. So I just want to raise a question here from the Yad Ramah before we start the Agadata for today. Today is the day of Agadata. I didn't write the text, I didn't write the script, so you can't blame me. My Rebbe, Zichron Levracha, would very often skip Haggadita because he held that we don't have the keys to understand the Haggadita, but we'll try our best to go through the Haggadita. But before we do that, I just want to add one piece to the puzzle, and that's the question of the Yad Ramah. The Aramas says that this migu that we're operating with in our Gemara, and we saw it in Ravin, is not similar to migu elsewhere. And he says the following: the afim lo nomar kan migu. Even if we reject migu, which is the position of Rav Dimi, right? That was the first transmission. That doesn't mean that elsewhere we're going to reject migu. And it's very important that we understand that our migu here in this sugya is a very unique kind of a migu, which really casts a suspicion, as we said before, on the credibility of the tovea of the plaintiff, because we've already proven that at least half his claim was false. And the Yad Ramah says the following: that the difference between Rav Dimi and Ravin is the following. If we have a possibility of passing Edim through Migu, Ravin, which was the last presentation that we did today, accepts in Rav Meir's frame of reference the possibility of passing Edim through Migu. That's the position of Ravin. Rav Dimi rejects this because he holds that migu is not enough to passel edim. Edim are invincible, in a sense, according to this pshat. It means that they have a cheskes kashrus, and we're going to have to, in order to cast any suspicion or aspersion on the kashrus of the edim, we're going to have really solid evidence. And the lack of any solid evidence, you can't apply migus to come and passel edim. Okay, Rabosai, let's see how we're going to do. Gufa. Gufa is a word that always indicates that we're going back to a statement that appeared earlier in the sugya, and now we want to embellish it and analyze it on a deeper level. We had a quote earlier, Omer Ish Lakish. We had a problem in Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that the defendant can passel the edim that are coming to testify against him, and how is that possible? Or, for example, in the case of Dayanim, these Dayanim are assumed to be Dayanim Kshayrim, and yet the defendant has a right to say, according to Rabbi Meir, these are Dayanim Psulim. And we didn't understand how Rabbi Meir could say such a thing. And the one who expressed his amazement about this was Reish Lakish. And if you recall, back on Daf Chav Gimel, Reish Lakish says, Peh Kadosh Yomar Dover Zeh, how could the holiest of mouths, meaning Reb Meir, have said such a thing? And therefore, Reish Lakish was forced to reinterpret Rabbi Meir, because he held that Rabbi Meir was such a great giant that it couldn't have been that he would say such a thing. And instead of reading it Edov, he reads it as Edo, meaning Reish Lakish is willing to drop the Yud, which makes it into plural, and by doing so it makes it into singular. Edo means his single witness, which means that Reuven, the Tovea, only brought one single witness into Beis Din. And although at some point maybe Shimon the Nitva was willing to accept that witness, but then he decided, no, he doesn't want to accept that witness. Now, all that is relevant to the sugya that we learned on Daf Chav Gimel. What we're learning now on Daf Chav Dalid is the admiration of Reish Lakish for Rabbi Meir. Now, Reish Lakish, as we'll soon see, was considered almost the greatest in his time. Maybe he was second only to Rabbi Yochanan, but even to Rabbi Yochanan by a hair's breadth. The Gemara says that every time Rabbi Yochanan said a shtickel Torah, Reish Lakish would slug him up with 24 counter arguments. That's how great Reish Lakish was. In fact, when Reish Lakish got sick at the end of his life, Rabbi Yochanan went berserk. He lost his marbles, as we'd say. The Gemara says they even prayed that Rabbi Yochanan should die because Rabbi Yochanan couldn't live without Reish Lakish. I mean, anyway, but leaving that on the side, the Gemara operates here in this Agadah with a premise. Again, I'm not comfortable with this premise, but that's the best I can do right now. Is that someone on a great level, like Reish Lakish, could not have possibly placed a contemporary of his on a greater level than him. Now, you and I know that there's something called modesty. The Gemara here, for some reason, and again, I'm very uncomfortable about this at this point. Hopefully, I'll be able to understand this better as we go along. But right now, I'm totally in the dark. The Gemara is completely oblivious or completely ignores the concept of modesty here. There's no room for modesty here. And what that means is that the Gemara can't figure out how Reish Lakish is putting Rabbi Meir on such a high level that Reish Lakish says, I have to rack my brains to figure out what Rabbi Meir really had in mind, even if it means changing the script of Rabbi Meir from Edov to Edo. And the Gemara doesn't understand it. Aini. Who is Reish Lakish? What is Reish Lakish? Is a second rate, you know, he's a pitcher in the bullpen, you know, he's not in the starting lineup. He's second class citizen. That he has to say about Rabbi Meir, who is a contemporary of his, that Rabbi Meir was a pek hadosh, he was a holy mouth, and it couldn't be that he said what he said, and now we have to reinterpret what he said. Such a commitment to Rabbi Meir means that he not only adores Rabbi Meir, but he idolizes him within the Mesores, the transmission of Torah. And that's impossible for us to understand. Because if we appreciate who Reish Lakish is, it's impossible for us to understand that Reish Lakish puts himself on a lower level than Rabbi Meir. Again, forget about humility now. If you can ask me a kash about humility, then I'm in deep trouble. Because I'm being very humble today, and I don't know why the Gemara is completely oblivious to humility. We'll see what the Masifta is able to do. He has a footnote on this. But the Gemara is not operating with humility.
Isn't he being humbled by humbling himself below?
Right. Again, I ask you not to ask me that question because the Gemara,
because
the Gemara is totally oblivious to humility. Humility doesn't exist. For some reason, there's no room for humility here. We're talking about Mesoras HaTorah, and within the Mesoras HaTorah, you have to know exactly your place, and there's no room for humility. And again, I'm very uncomfortable about that thought, but I can't answer that question right now. So the Gemara asks, "Va'omar Ula." Now, Ula is a second generation Amora. And he had a little bit of a contact and a vision of Reish Lakish. So what did he say about Reish Lakish? He says, "Arois Reish Lakish bebeis hamedrash." If you would only have a vision, a little bit of a peep of what Reish Lakish was like in Torah learning when he was involved in the Beis Medrash, is keilu oker harim v'tochnon zebazeh. You could only compare it to see someone. Could you imagine if? Who were the great giants? What were Gulliver's Travels? What was it? I'm trying to remember those giants, right? Imagine if a giant would lift up and completely uproot two major mountains, then take these mountains that are standing, that each one is sitting on his arm, combine it to bang the two mountains together, v'tochnan, and turn them into little pieces of sand. In other words, Reish Lakish was so brilliant that if you got stuck with a mountain, meaning you couldn't figure out a sugya, the Torah was very elusive and for you was very ambiguous, he would come, lift up the mountain, and he could do this with two mountains, and he could combine them together and make them into solder, make them into sand. Now, in the footnote here, he says that the Gemara in Bava Metzia elsewhere talks about the great ability of Reish Lakish, his sharpness in Torah. And he says that the word harim, mountains here, is a word of symbolism, and it represents halachos, kvuos, ubruros. So imagine, let's say the following, I'm just making up a scenario. Rabbi Yochanan comes into the Beis Medrash, and he offers a halacha, and it's clear, and it's kavua, meaning it has no exceptions. Comes along Reish Lakish with his charifus, with his sharpness, with his koach ha-pilpul, his power of dialectic analysis, and he could be oker this har, this mountain. This mountain is halacha kvua ubrura, and he could show that something that you thought was tameh is really tar, and the reverse. That's how great Reish Lakish is. And the Yad Ramah adds another piece to the puzzle. What does it mean, tochnan zebazeh, that he smashes them together and grinds them down to a powder? He pulverizes these two mountains. He says, ein dover kosher shahoya ben haharim sheinu nitchad umisporer. He says the following. Sometimes when you answer a question, and especially if you answer two different problems, two different questions, there's still something in between that really wasn't clarified. But when Reish Lakish came to the scene, not only could he clarify these great different issues, but he would even smash them together so that there was nothing between these two mountains that was left on ground, that was left, you know, up in the air. But now he says the following, Yesh la hakshos. Let's raise the following question. Afal gav Reish Lakish hayacharif v'gadol. He says, even if Reish Lakish was great, however, Reb Meir was a Tana, and Reish Lakish was an Amora. Now, we have a distinction within the framework of Mesiras HaTorah between the Tanoim and Amoraim. For example, an Amora cannot disagree with a Tana. And again, Rabotzai, you know, if I start thinking about the greatness of a Tana, I start shaking. It's beyond our comprehension what it means to be a Tana. Even if you want to think about what it means to be an Amora, it's beyond comprehension. You know, somebody once said to the Gaon that maybe he's as great, the Vilna Gaon, maybe he's as great as the Rambam. So the Gaon responded, impossible. Maybe I'm as great as the Ramban. He said, maybe. But never would the Gaon say that I'm as great as an Amora, and certainly not as a Tana. So therefore, we don't understand. The Gemara says, how did Reish Lakish say about Reb Meir that he's the Peh Kadosh? After all, Reish Lakish is no slouch. But the answer is that Reish Lakish is an Amora. V'roi lo likro lo l'Rabbi Meir b'derech anova. Again, it's almost our question about anova, about humility. Not exactly. He throws in the variable that Rabbi Meir is a Tana, and therefore Reish Lakish has to treat Rabbi Meir with all the humility in the world. Mai kusha sagamora kishakar pekadosh. So he quotes an answer from a sefer called the Pnei Maven. Now, I'm not a maven, so I don't know if I'm going to understand this mavinus here of the Pnei Maven, but I'll just tell you what he says. He says, Vadai, there's no question in the Gemara's mind, Reish Lakish hayu mechabed es Rabbi Meir harbe v'harbe. So what was the Gemara's question? Kusha samakshin hi, madua Reish Lakish yoma Rabbi Meir dvarim shi mashma mihem shedivir Rabbi Meir him adifim al dvara. So again, this is the Pnei Maven, the face of the Maven. I'm not a Maven, so I don't know what he's saying over here. He just says the following. There's no question in our minds that the Gemara never doubted that Reish Lakish had all the respect in the world for Rabbi Meir. But what the Gemara couldn't understand is, how did Reish Lakish put Rabbi Meir on such a high level as if to say that he, Reish Lakish, he has nothing to say in the matter. Like his opinion would not even be valid in the light of Rabbi Meir. But then we have to therefore somehow rewrite the text of Rabbi Meir and so forth. Again, as I told you, I'm very uncomfortable with this. I'm not sure why the Gemara thinks that there's a problem in Reish Lakish calling Rabbi Meir Peh Kadosh. But in any event, Ravina rejects this whole question. Omar Ravina, halo kol haroa es Rabbi Meir, you think that Reish Lakish is great? You have no clue, because you don't know how great Rabbi Meir is. You think that Reish Lakish is so great that how could he have possibly put Rabbi Meir on a higher pedestal? Halo kol haroa es Rabbi Meir v'beis hamedrash. Now, I'm not sure, I don't know the history here, if somebody could research this for me, was Ravina old enough to have seen Rabbi Meir? I don't know. It could be that Ravina had a certain tradition let's say Rabbi Meir was 50 years before Ravina, but Ravina may have known certain greats who saw Rabbi Meir and knew Rabbi Meir, and they testified that if you saw Rabbi Meir learning Torah, is ki'ilu oker hare harim v'tochnan zebozeh. Rabbi Meir was even greater than Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish would take two average tall mountains and he could grind them together. But Rabbi Meir was even greater. He could take the tallest of all mountains and uproot them and then grind them together and turn them into a pulp. And therefore Reish Lakish calls Rabbi Meir Pek Kadosh, because Reish Lakish really recognized the fact that Rabbi Meir was that much greater than him. So again, the Makshin thought that Reish Lakish is so great based on the description of Ula that there's no one who could beat out Reish Lakish. He was the greatest of the greats, and therefore we don't understand why he put Rabbi Meir on a higher pedestal. But the Gemara's Maskana is, based on the Teretz of Ravina, that Rabbi Meir was even greater than Reish Lakish. Now again, in the light of our symbolism about the fact that a mountain means a, when you get stuck in a sugya, you don't understand the Gemara, Hare Harim would be like, I don't know if you're familiar in Rabbi Kivega's language, sometimes he writes Tzorach Iyun, you know, I don't have an answer, but sometimes he writes Tzorach Iyun Gadol. Did you ever hear that? When he adds the word Gadol, he basically is claiming that there's no answer to this question. Don't even bother with it. So that's called Hare Harim. And even on a question that would fit into the description of Hare Harim, we're still going to say that Rabbi Meir is going to be able to be Oker, he'll be able to uproot such a question, which is a Tzarech Iyun Gadol. That's how great Rabbi Meir is, and that puts Rabbi Meir on a greater pedestal than Reish Lakish. So it's almost as if the Gemara is saying that if you had a machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Reish Lakish, in the Habmini we thought it would be a teku. You know, Reish Lakish is greater than Rabbi Meir, or at least as great as Rabbi Meir. But the maskana is no, we would accept Rabbi Meir against Reish Lakish. He's been greater than Reish Lakish, and that's why Reish Lakish used the terminology Pei Kadosh when he described Rabbi Meir. So the Gemara now says Hachi Kamar. The Gemara now, in a sense, is sort of backpedaling and saying that when we asked the question Eini, right, that was the question that we raised before Ravina came to answer that question, we really didn't mean to ask the question exactly the way Ravina understood it. What rather, we were making an observation. We were realizing something about Reish Lakish that would be typical of something that goes way beyond Reish Lakish himself. What did we observe about Reish Lakish? And the answer is Chavivus. So let's take a second to speak about the word Chavivus. Chavivus means when you adore someone and you cherish them and you put them on a very high pedestal. And what does Rav Meir and Reish Lakish have in common? What do they have in common? We divide up the Mesores of the Talmud into two different areas. There's what's called Bavel, and hence we have what's called the Talmud Bavli. And then we have the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael. Now the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, although they also had their Talmudic discourses, but basically they became famous and their transmission of the Torah became part of the Mesorah because of the Talmud Bavel. And what happens is, we have various people, like we spoke about Rav Dimi and Ravin, who would travel back and forth from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel and bring to Bavel the Torah of the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael. But the Gemara claims that this statement of Reish Lakish, this excitement and drama that Reish Lakish talks about Rav Meir as Pei Kadosh, this is a reflection of the relationship between Chachmei Eretz Yisrael. We only hope that today, Mirtz Hashem, in Eretz Yisrael, we can reflect this kind of relationship. I know of one great yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael where the Talmidim sit on two sides of the Beis Medrash. It's basically two different yeshivas in the same Beis Medrash. And sometimes they get into fights. So that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, that mechavavim zeh zeh, that there was a special love and respect between amongst the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael. Reish Lakish was one of the Chachomim of Eretz Yisrael in the generation beyond Rabbi Meir. And Hachi Kamer, this is what the Gemara wanted to make a comment on. Not the way Ravina understood, how could Reish Lakish speak about Rabbi Meir in such high terms. But Adarabba, we were making an observation. Bo Re'e, as we would say in modern English, check this out. Kama Mechavavim Zetze, how much do the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael cherish one another? Reish Lakish was such a great Chacham, and yet his Chavivus, his adoration for Rabbi Meir was so great that he called him Peh Kadosh. And he worked overtime and did somersaults in the air to try to make sense out of Rabbi Meir's statement, even if it meant changing the text. And now, the Gemara embarks upon an analysis, or shall we say, a description of the Chavivus of the Tanoim one to the other. Now, in order to understand the next piece of Gemara, let's just introduce a concept called Hatmana. And this is a concept in Hilchos Shabbos that has to do with Meleches Bishul. And Hatmana means when you put something underground. Let's say you have, let's say, cooked food that's hot, and you want to make sure that it retains its heat. So you wrap it around. Let's say either you actually, the case of underground, that would be a slightly different case. That would be a case where you had something cold and you wanted to keep it cold. So the sand on the ground will keep it cold during the winter time. But then you have hatmana, like for example, let's say you would take a chilling pot and you would completely surround it and insulate it in such a way that it would retain its heat. So that's not bishul, because he's not cooking anything, there's no fire that's going, but the Chachamim were worried about this case and they called it Hatmana. Hatmana means when you submerge it, or in this case you wrap it around. Why? Because they used to wrap it around with something that was Mosif Hevel. In other words, the heat was increasing as it went along. And if you put, let's say, certain kinds of substances that are hot around the pot, and the pot is hot, then that they sort of kick off each other and it increases the heat and it becomes very similar to bishul. So on a d'oraisa level, that's not called cooking, but the Rabbanan consider it hatmana. Our Gemara that we're about to embark upon, which is all about the chavivus of the Tanoim, the love and adoration between two Tanoim, is going to address the case of hatmana of tzonen, which means that you have cold water, for example, and you're afraid that it'll get warm, and you want to maintain its level of coldness, and they didn't have refrigeration like we had today. So the question is, are you allowed to take this cold water in a receptacle and submerge it under the sand? And that's called a type of hatmana, but again, it's not the hatmana that we spoke about before, which is mosif chom, that adds heat, but here it's a hatmana to preserve the coldness of a foodstuff. And the chachamim, the rabbana, were afraid that if we're going to allow him to do hatmana on tzonen, he might mistakenly confuse that with hatmana of cham, of something that's hot, and hatmana of something hot is prohibited. So again, we're not learning Hilchos Shabbos now, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of a background as to what the issue is. The Gemara quotes Rebbe, Ki Hadi Yosef Rebbe. Rebbe was sitting and he was teaching his Talmidim, v'ka'amar, and he said to them, Asur lahatmin esatzonein b'Shabbos. I'm adding the word b'Shabbos, meaning you're not allowed to take cold water in a vessel and surround it with sand, by submerging it in sand, in order to maintain its coldness, and because he's going to come to be matmin, even something that's cham, something that's hot. And hatmana of hot food, in a davar shemosif hevel, is certainly osur. Now, if you do hatmana on something hot, in a way that it'll preserve its heat without increasing its heat, that's a sugya in the second perek of Shabbos, perek Kira, on Daf Lamed Daleth. Amar lefanav. Now, who was sitting at the time in front of Rebbe? It was Rabbi Yishmael b'Rabbi Yossi. And Rabbi Shmuel says about his father, Rabbi Yossi, Hiter lahatmin es hatzone. Now, what's going on here? Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi had just committed himself and publicized the formulation that you're not allowed to be matmin tzone. And now Rabbi Shmuel is quoting his father, Rabbi Yossi, as saying that my father was matir tzone. Okay, so at this point I would have said that there's a machlokas here between Rebbe and Rabbi Yossi, and that's fine. You know, did the Chachamim, when they prohibited hatmona, did they limit it to something that's hot, or did they extend it even to include something that's cold? But that's not what happens. Amale, Rebbe says to Rabbi Shmuel, I rescind my original position. Forget about what I told you. Kvar hora zaken. Now the word zaken, which literally means an elder person, means a chacham, right? Zikna, which is the noun of a zaken, is chachma, is wisdom. And the phrase kvar hora zaken, which we're seeing for the first time here, is imitated and repeated all throughout Shas. So we got the first dibs, you know, we got the preview of coming attractions. Kfar Hora Zaken. In fact, in all the tshuva literature, if you would take out Bar Ilan and do a research, I don't know if you're familiar with the Bar Ilan project, and you would do a word search for Kfar Hora Zaken, those three words will appear thousands of times in the tshuva literature. And what does Kfar Hora Zaken mean? That although I have my opinion, forget about my opinion. I completely backtrack from my opinion. Why? Because Kfar Hora Zaken. In this case, it means that your father, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi, already gave his opinion, and therefore, I completely backtrack on my opinion. Omar Rav Papa heard the story, and he made the following comment. Bo re'e, check this out. Kamach mechavavin, how much do the Tanoim adore one another? Zed said. De'ilu Rabbi Yossi Kayam. Rabbi Shmuel was quoting his late father, but had Rabbi Yossi been alive, Hayakofu for Yosef Lufnei Rebbe, he would sit in front of Rebbe like a Talmud sits in front of his rabbi, of his master. Now that's interesting because I'm just going to tell you a little story from my youth. I was a student in high school of Rav Nissim Alpert. I don't know if you ever heard of him. He was the disciple of Rav Moshe Feinstein, probably the number one disciple of all time. It was Rav Nissim Alpert. Unfortunately, he died at a relatively young age. I don't even think he reached his 65th birthday. But Rav Nissim Alpert was great in his own right. He once showed me notebooks upon notebooks of his handwritten chidushim manuscripts. And whenever he could, he would come to hear Rav Soloveitchik. He would take his time in order to sit in the class with young boys who were about 20 years old. He was already in his 60s, but it didn't matter. He just had such adoration for Rav Soloveitchik that he would come and sit in the class. And the Gemara is saying the same thing about Rabbi Shmuel. If Rebbe was giving a class, then Rabbi Shmuel, I'm sorry about Rabbi Yossi, I meant to say, that Rabbi Yossi, as great as he was, he would actually participate in the class. You know, today we have a new phenomenon. Nobody wants to go to classes. You know, it's below my dignity. But back in the day, even someone as great as Rabbi Yossi, who's a Tana that's quoted on every other page in Shas almost, he would come and take the time to sit in front of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. He was kafu for Yosef Lifnei Rebbe. He would sit there in a position, you know, you could see, you know, body language, that he would be kafu. He considered himself secondary to Rabbi Meir. To Rebbe, because Rebbe was greater than him in Chachma. Dor Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi, Memale Mokam Avosav Hoyev, Hoyev Kafu for Yosef Lifnei Rebbe. And I'll prove it to you. The Gemara says that Rabbi Shmuel took over the legacy for his father. After Rabbi Yossi died, Rabbi Shmuel took over for his father. He was a mamali makom. He became the next in command, the substitute. Like if you know about Hasidim, who's going to be the next Rebbe? So that Rabbi Yossi, the father, trained his son and raised him and taught him to prepare him so that Rabbi Shmuel would be ready to take over the leadership after Rabbi Yossi died. And yet, Rabbi Shmuel was kafu for Yosef Lifnei Rebbe. So both Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shmuel were kafu for Yosef Lifnei Rebbe. And nevertheless, V'ka'omar, and yet Rebbe said, Kfar Hora Zaken, that if Rabbi Yossi has already given his opinion, I rescind my opinion. That is the great chavivus that Rebbe had for Rabbi Yossi. Now, Rabbi Yossi, what you see here, which is unfolding in front of our eyes, is a distinction between what I call theoretical halacha and normative halacha, or practical halacha. And there are two sets of rules and regulations. So very often people think, well, you know, I've studied the Talmud, I'm about to make a siyum on Shas, I can paskin shilas. But that's not true. Because horas halacha, when you want to be moreh din, is a whole different slew of regulations that govern that. It's a whole different way of operating. The mechanics is totally different. You can have a theoretical understanding that the halacha should be X, but you're going to have to remove that opinion in terms of halacha lemaisa, what I call normative halacha, in light of the rules that govern normative halacha. And you see this over and over again. So for example, in our Gemara, just to give you this example that we're studying now, Rebbe came to the conclusion that Hatmana includes not only a Dabar Cham, but even a Dabar Tzonen. But that's not Halacha L'maisa. Because when it comes to Halacha L'maisa, there's a rule called Kfar Hora Zaken, which means that if one of the great Chachamim, in this case Rabbi Yossi, has already issued his formulation and his ruling in this case, then Rebbe says, I have to have a tremendous amount of adoration and respect for Rabbi Yossi, then, you know, my understanding was very, you know, very nice in the abstract conceptual world of understanding the Talmud and Halacha, but as far as normative practical law, we have a different rule. What's that rule called? Kfar Hora Zaken. Now, at this point, we have the Agadata, which is called Chavivus Chachmei Eretz Yisrael Elu Es Elu. This is the name of the game. And the Gemara wants to show us, based on psukim and drashos, how the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael would work in tandem. They had mutual respect. And as I said at the outset, halavai, that we should see this in our day. Omer Rabbi Oshaya, my dechsiv, what does the pasuk mean in Sefer Zechariah? And the Navi says, "Va'akach li shnei maklos li echad karasi noam uli echad karasi chovlim." I'm going to read the last three words in the pasuk. It says, "Va'ere es hatzon." It's a very banal and kind of innocuous pasuk. It doesn't say anything bombastic. It says that I took two sticks, and one I called noam, and the other I called chovlim. And I use them to shepherd my sheep. Now, if you look in the parsha in Zechariah in its own context, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Zechariah what exactly happened, what befell the people of Israel at the beginning of Malchus Beis David, all the way till Tzidkiyahu HaNavi. Tzidkiyahu HaMelech was the king of that experienced Golus. So that David HaMelech is in Yerushalayim, prepares the building of the Beis HaMikdash, Shlomo builds the Mikdash, and we have many Malachim, and that's in Eretz Yisrael. But then, with Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, the people of Israel are exiled. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to Zechariah, and he says the following. He says that you should know there are two kings of Israel, and these kings are going to be called by two different names. One is Noam, and the other is Chovlim. Who are these two different kings? So if you take a look in Zechariah Navi, we're talking about Yeravam and Rechavam. Yeravam ben Nevat and Rechavam ben Shlomo. Yeravam is going to be a... what's the opposite of a despot, of a tyrant? What's the opposite? When a king is very magnanimous and he's very giving and he's very compassionate, what?
Benevolent.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So there are two kings. One is called Noam and the other is called Chovlin. One reigns with benevolence, and that is Yeravam, who's a very soft king, and that's called Noam. Noam means Bineimus, with sensitivity and compassion. And then there's somebody called Rechavam. Rechavam, he's molech biyad kosher. He rules the people like a tyrant, like a despot, with a very heavy hand. And he's called in the Nevuah to Zechariah Chovlim. Chovlim means those are the destroyers. You know, they are the ones who use the very powerful weapons. And there's a whole discussion there amongst the Rishonim in Zechariah Novi whether or not this is a reference to what's called Malchus Beis Chashmonoi. That during the period of after the Nes of Chanukah, when the Chashmonoim were victorious against the Greeks, the Hellenists, then at that point Malchus goes back to the Beis Chashmonoim. And the question is, what kind of Malchus did they have? And it could be that during there were 200 years of Malchus Beis Chashmonoi, and sometimes there was Noam, and sometimes there was Chovlin. However, Rav Yoshi is going to take this pasuk completely out of context, because he's wondering at the end of the pasuk, it says, Va'er'eh es hatzon, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is now being compared to a shepherd who is shepherding his son is Klal Yisrael. And sometimes the roeh, the shepherd, has to be a bit harsh. You know, he has a stick in his hand, and he has to get the animals round up when he shepherds them, make sure they're all in line. So he uses a makel. And this entire situation of God shepherding Klal Yisrael, and sometimes it's Benoam, and sometimes it's with Chovlim, sometimes it's compassion and soft sensitivity, other times it's very harsh and very demanding. This is all, according to Rav Oshia, a simile that should be understood as representative, symbolically, of the way God rules over the people with Talmidei Chachamim. The Talmidei Chachamim are those who will give the final verdict, and they will issue the decisions about how God's Torah should be fulfilled. And that's called Horas Din. And there are two categories of Talmidei Chachamim who, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, are Roeh Es Hatzon. They are shepherding Klal Yisrael. There's one category of Talmud Chachamim which are called Chovlim, and there's another which are called Noam. So again, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the way he treats Klal Yisrael, sometimes he shepherds them with a makel, with harshness, that's called Chovlim. Sometimes it's b'ne'imus, and that's called Noam. So too, there are two categories of Talmud Chachamim that are going to rule, so to speak. They're going to determine the halacha for Klal Yisrael. And Noam is the first category that Rav Oshia speaks about. Who are the Talmidei Chacham that are called Noam? Those are the scholars of Eretz Yisrael. Shemanimim ze lo ze b'halacha. Their sensitivity creates a brotherhood, a kind of a partnership in which they work together in tandem in b'ne'imus. So for example, if you say something and I disagree with you, I'm not going to harshly, you know, disagree with you. I'm going to try to embellish, and I'm trying to work with you, and that's called man'imim zeh et zeh b'alocha. However, there's another category of Talmid Chachamim, and they are called by the Navi Chovlim, the Elu Talmid Chachamim shebebavel. So if someone is a Talmud Chacham in Bavel, typically, when other scholars disagree with him, they battle him like it's a holy war. Shemechablim zed zebaloch. Everyone, you know, tries to undermine the other person and express a different opinion, and I don't agree with you, and throw the book at you, and that's called Mechablim zed zed. When it comes to Eretz Yisrael, it was a whole different relationship. The interrelationship between the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael was not that they were throwing books at each other and yelling at each other and you're wrong and I'm right and I'll prove it to you and so forth and so on, in that belligerent kind of aggressive tone of voice. It was b'ne'imus. And that's what we saw before about Reish Lakish in Eretz Yisrael, the way he spoke with such adoration and sensitivity about Rabbi Meir, calling him a Pe Kadosh. We saw it in the case of Rebbe, that even though he disagreed with Rabbi Yossi, nevertheless Kfar Hor is Zaken, and that's called Ne'imus. And this pasuk says Rabbi Yoshia in Zechariah, that speaks about the shepherds who shepherd Binoam, is a reference to the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. Now I have a note here, a short note that I wanted to share with you in the name of the Pesach Einayim. I'm not familiar with the Sefer. He says, Kevon she'achachomim she'beretzil nochim zelazeh, because they treated each other with such compassion and adoration, harehem ke'echad, they're like one. And therefore, if you take a look at the pasuk in Zechariah, he doesn't say man'imim. In the Sefer, he says Chovlim in the plural, but in the Reisha, when he talks about Eretz Yisrael, he calls them Noam in the singular. And the answer is, it's like one Yachid, it's like one individual, because when you work together, then the manifold become one, and they're all integrated into one indivisible unit. When it gets to the Chachmei Bavel, he uses the term Chovlim. Why? Because they are separate one from the other. They are individuals that fight each other, and if that be the case, there's no echad over here. It's each one, each man for himself, so to speak, and that's called chovlim in the plural. So we see here that there are two fundamental principles here. One fundamental principle is what we call achdus, which means the unity of the chachamim, of the talmidei chacham. They work together as one, and they're called noam in singular as one. And another principle here is about Eretz Yisrael, that somehow the land and the atmosphere in Eretz Yisrael was conducive to raise Talmidei Chachamim Bine'imus, that would have a self-mutual respect and zelazeh. Now, I don't know, Rabosai, honestly, how to reconcile this Gemara with a very famous Gemara you're all familiar with in Yevamos. The Gemara talks about the period of time between Pesach and Shavuos, which we call the Sfira period. And the Gemara says it's a very sad period in Jewish history, in which Rabbi Akiva lost 24,000 of his students. And the Gemara says, why? Because Shelo Nagu Kavod Zebazeh. And that would seem to undermine everything that we've said over here, because the way we describe the Talmidei Chachamim of Eretz Yisrael is that Mani'imim Zedzeh. They had a relationship that was Noach Zelazeh, a great deal of adoration and mutual respect. That doesn't seem to be typical. But maybe the answer is Hianosenes, because the level of Eretz Yisrael was so great, and the Talmidim Chachamim is so Ne'imim Zelazeh. In the case of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, we expected much better. And the demands were much higher. And the punishment was much more harsh. So what does it mean that they weren't Mechabit Zelazeh? What were they guilty of? Did they call each other by bad names? Is that what happened to the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva? Chas v'shalom. But in some subtle sense, very subtle, something that you and I probably would miss on the surface of it, they were not mechabdim zedzeh. There was some nuance or minuscule, hair's breadth fraction, a feather amount of cover that was lacking one to the other. And given the great ne'imus of the Talmidei Chachamim Sheberetz Yisrael, this was considered on that level to be unacceptable. Again, the punishment was too harsh. I don't know. That I can't answer. But we do see that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is medagdek im hatzadikim kechut hasayra. That's something that for you and I would not be considered a violation, but for a tzaddik on his level, relative to his level, is considered a violation. So I would submit to you that the Talmidei Chachamim who studied at the feet of Rabbi Akiva were on such a high level that we expected more of them, and therefore the punishment was very harsh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was very medagdik with these Talmidei Chachamim kechut hasayra. Now the Gemara introduces another drasha, also from the same book of Zechariah. Before we were studying the 11th chapter of Zechariah, now we're rewinding to the 4th chapter of Zechariah. And once again, we're going to use this pasuk to shed a light on a description of the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. Vayomer Ela Shnei Bnei Hayitzar Ha'omdim, and then it says Haladon Kol Ha'aretz. So this first pasuk speaks about Yitzhar. Yitzhar means when you take grapes and you crush them and you extract the liquid from the grapes. That's called Yitzhar. And then in another pasuk, which is in the same chapter, the fourth chapter of Zechariah, it says Ushnayim Zesim Aleha, Echad Miyamin Hagula V'Echad Al Smola. So it's very interesting. We have one pasuk that speaks about Yitzhar, which is the extract from grapes, and then we have another pasuk that speaks about Zesim, and that means the extract from olives. So the Gemara dashes it in the following way. Yitzhar, if you're talking about Yitzhar, I made a mistake here. I'm sorry. I said that Yitzhar is from what? From grapes. I expected, that was just a test to see if you would scream me out of here. Okay, so maybe you're asleep today. I don't know.
It's oil, isn't it?
Oil, right. Yitzhar is oil. I made a mistake. Zesim is the original olive, the natural olive in its natural state. And Yitzhar means after you crush the olive and you remove its oil. Okay, so I'm sorry about that. So Gemara says the following. Yitzhar, what is the symbolic reference here? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Elu Talmidei Chacham Sheberetz Yisrael, Shenochim Ze Laze Ba'alocha Keshemen Zayis. So the symbolic representation of oil here is Nochim Ze Laze. Whereas Shnayim Zesim Oleh, the original olive, is Elu Talmidei Chacham Shebabel Shemorerin Laze Laze Ba'alocha Kezayis. Now, I don't know how many of you love olives. I mean, I love olives. And I passed it on to my children. And it's not always such a great idea, because if you don't have any olives, then you're addicted to olives. But the truth is that our olives are not really the natural olives. If you pick an olive off an olive tree, it tastes very bitter. In fact, it's the Arabs who have developed they know exactly how to make zeisim the way we eat zeisim. It's a whole process, you know, it's very complicated. So that the zeisim that hit our table, that's a result of a great amount of so to speak, technology. But the original zayis in its natural form is bitter. Whereas shemen zayis is wonderful. You know, you take shemen zayis, you dip things into it, you use it for so many different things. Today, by the way, I think the scientists believe that amongst the various oils, you know, olive oil is up there on the top or close to the top. It's much healthier than other oils. And olive oil now becomes a symbol here in Zechariah's frame of reference of the Talmidei Chachamim Sheberetz Yisrael. Shenochim ze laze ba'alocha. Nochim means that they support each other. They work again, as we said before, together as a group. And that gives a certain sweetness and a certain lovely taste to the Torah itself, to the halacha itself. The halacha is developed as a joint effort. It's not like chavrusas that learn together and yell at each other and they throw shtenders at each other and they're angry at each other. No. Here you have two chavrusas in Eretz Yisrael and they're working together in tandem. The beauty of that Torah is like the beauty of Shemen Zayis. It's clear. However, unfortunately in Babel, it's Morin Zela Zebalah. Now, I would add the following footnote, and unfortunately I can't find anyone who says this. You know, this something that's good, if it's too good, sometimes has a drawback to it. Do you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Isn't it true that, you know, even the Tzad HaTov, if you go too far, and in the flip side, even the Tzad HaLotov, you know, you're talking about Marirus, and you're talking about Chovlim Zetzeh, in the case of Chachmei Bavel, even that has a good point to it. Because imagine if the two of us are learning a sugya, and you express an opinion, and I think that you're wrong. So instead of arguing with you, because I have a certain respect and adoration for you, so I build up what you say. you know, it's wonderful in terms of the unity and the achdus and the beinonim lechavero and the sensitivity and the mutual sensitivity, but maybe the Torah loses out. Why am I saying this? Because if I were to ask you, if you, in your youth, let's say, maybe now you've already gone through Shas a number of times, but if you were still in your young developing years, you have two choices. You can dedicate your time to learning Yerushalmi or to Bavli. What would you do? Bavli, for sure. I mean, all that we study is Bavli. I mean, I learned with many great scholars, Rav Soloveitchik and so forth, and they never taught us Yerushalmi. I mean, sometimes we had to refer to Yerushalmi. But our limud was in Bavli, and it was endless. It was a bottomless pit. I mean, Bavli is endless. So it's very strange. On the one hand, the Gemara is lauding the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael. And on the other hand, we study Bavli, the Torah of Bavel. That's where the transmission of Torah took place, in Bavel. And yet these are described as Talmidei Chachamim, Shechovlim Zedzeh, Shemorim Lehem Zedzeh Balocha. Now again, there may be historical answers to my question, that the reason why we don't study Talmud Yerushalmi. So what I'm telling you is just on a theoretical level, conceptually. I'm not talking in historical context, but rather in an ethical context. That it could be that the dialectic of Bavel is what contributes to the greatness of the Talmud Bavli. And that dialectic was a result of a certain kind of interrelationship in which the scholars would be at each other's throats, so to speak, in arguing with all the passion and all the feeling. That if I thought you were wrong, I might get up out of my chair and scream and yell at the top of my lungs. And the reason for that is because I'm passionately involved in the search for truth. And that intellectual honesty could be expressed and described as morim zelazeh. It's a little like, you know, if you stick me with a needle and you say, well, you're wrong because I'll prove it to you from here, there, and elsewhere, you know, that's a little bit painful. That's bitter for me. And you're really destroying me. But it's all within the context of amita shel Torah, to try to clarify the Torah. And to clarify the truth of the Torah, you have to work hard. And you have to sometimes pit one opinion against the other. And it could be a very harsh kind of experience. Okay, Rabbi Oseh, there's a lot more here on this Agadita, but I think we made a Haskalah. If anyone happens to have a pencil, I would love to make a note of where we got to here. Oh, here's a pencil. Can I borrow this for just a second? So we got to V'Esayinai, which is another pasuk in Zechariah, that also continues on this vein. Okay then, so everyone should have a great day.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for participating in the shiur.